The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
This playing around with President Trump's letter that he put out over the weekend that it reset the clock, it's all fiction. None of it has anything to do with the actual law. It's just to make people not ask hard questions that allow him to keep doing whatever he wants. That's the truth of it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this special Iran War episode we're doing today. And today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming to the show someone whose work I truly admire, a rare voice in today's noisy world who consistently chooses, facts and truth over emotion and hyperbole. Joining us today is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, a 21-year combat veteran who served four deployments to the front lines, including Operation Desert Storm, where he earned the Bronze Star for Valor at the Battle of 73 Easting, Iraq in 2009, two tours in Afghanistan, where he earned a second Bronze Star. And after seeing the realities of war up close and personal, Colonel Davis became one of the most courageous truth tellers, which is so important today in national security. So in 2012, he publicly exposed the gap between official Washington spin and what was actually happening on the ground in Afghanistan. And we're hopefully going to be doing the same gap today. So today is a senior fellow at the Defense Priorities and host of the outstanding Daniel Davis Deep Dive. He delivers clear-eyed, evidence-based analysis on the war, foreign policy, national security. We're going to cut straight through the hype today. Colonel Davis, it's really good to have you on the program today.
Absolute joy to be here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
So I got to dive right in. This is May 4th, where it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Things are breaking so fast, I have to put a timestamp on it. Does it look like the ceasefire is going to hold? Will diplomacy cut out, or are we about to escalate here?
Now, I mean, it seems, I mean, if we, just based on the anecdotal evidence we have so far, we have already had some escalation. I think that most people were looking at the ceasefire was more like a pause that both sides were using just to rearm and refit and get ready for the next phase, because there wasn't any actual genuine diplomacy that was going on in the meantime anyway, especially if you listen to what the Iranian side has said and what the U.S. side has said. They're literally talking like different planets, like they're not even coming close to narrowing any gaps. In fact, the gaps are actually expanding. And then now here we have all this activity with drones, missiles, naval engagements in the Gulf, burning port in UAE and one of the most important points on the Gulf of Oman side. And then lots of pretty boisterous claims by both the IRGC and President Trump. So, yeah, I mean, it looks to me like we're probably ready to get this thing back into high gear, which is disaster. And I hope it doesn't happen, but hard to see how we avoid it at this point.
Well, it seems to already have happened to some extent, and this was my worst outcome, honestly, which was that the Strait of Hormuz obviously being shut down. There used to be 25 million barrels per day of oil and products and other things, of course, coming out of there. That got stopped, but there was still a couple of sneak points left for oil to come out, and an important one was the east-west pipeline that goes out at Yanbu in the Red Sea for Saudi Arabia. But the other one you mentioned is this one. This is a big fire. So this is the one that down in Fujairah, they call it a 1.2 gigawatt fire. They measure fires in megawatts and gigawatts sort of intensity. That's a big fire. And the video I have seems to confirm this is not a good sign here.
No, it's not. And it's a double bad sign. Number one, just because it took place at all, this wasn't even alleged, somebody sabotaging or whatever. But at least according to the UAE, it was expressly drones that came from Iran. Apparently several waves of them come through. Most of them got shot down. All of them didn't. So just the fact that they launched a strike and not in retaliation to anything else is concerned that, you know, the whole conflict may be about to turn back on. But then it's also, for the reasons you've alluded to here, which port was hit. I mean, they could have fired at a lot of stuff, but shows the one that's one of two real avenues for Middle Eastern oil to get out besides the Gulf, the Strait. And there's, I can't remember the exact number, but there was a considerable amount of oil that has been going out through that port. And now then, presumably, or at least potentially, that's going to be curtailed or limited. I don't know the extent of the damage yet. I don't guess anybody does. But it certainly is going to have a negative impact, which is only going to add to all the problems you talk about already with this. I think it's somewhere around net 12 million barrels a day of oil not getting out. Now, that number could go up by 3 or 4 million barrels, depending on how serious the damage is. And, man, you're the last one I need to tell what that means for the global economy.
Well, yeah, no, even I don't know what that really truly means. We've never been through anything like this. This is the biggest, most sudden, damaging oil shock in world history. So we're all just going to have to play wait and see what comes out of this. But so far, you know, they've been leveraging the fog of war pretty heavily. It's gotten to the point, Daniel, where when a U.S. official says something, I just almost immediately believe the opposite of it. It's not even that I discount it. They tell me things like, oh, we have plenty of oil. Oh, don't worry. It'll all be over soon. Oh, we'll be back to normal in a few weeks. Oh, the strait is open. Somebody just said that today. I have contacts in the region. The strait is very much not open. In fact, there's rumors that U.S. warships had actually been struck. And those are rumors, fog of war. But we did get this today as well. This just came in a minute ago. Iran has targeted commercial and U.S. military ships with cruise missiles, U.S. Admiral says. That could be true, might not be. Everything's a little bit suspect these days.
Yeah, what Admiral Cooper has said is that there were several cruise missiles shot at a U.S. warship, but they claim to have knocked them all down and then claim to have sunk five of these fast boats in retaliation. But we also claim that we went through, this is a CENTCOM, official CENTCOM, saying that two American warships went through the Strait of Hormuz and then now are back in the Gulf of the Arabian Gulf, I think is what the way the phrase they used. And then two American flagged vessels were able to get through. I haven't seen any independent confirmation of that yet, but that would be really surprising to me if it was true. And like you said, I can't take anything at face value. I've got to wait until I see corroboration from elsewhere. But I don't know why we would send two warships through that strait now when Iran is already threatening to shoot down anything. I don't know what you would gain by that. And the fact that two vessels came out, that's good for those two vessels. But there's like a couple of thousand vessels that are stuck in there. So getting two out is really kind of meaningless. But you're taking a huge risk for our naval crews that are part of that. And then, of course, it's almost like you're taunting Iran to shoot, almost like you're hoping that that causes cause to restart this. And we have this morning, before that took place, Axios was reporting that some of their sources said that that's exactly what the administration was seeking to do, which was to send these ships through. And then if they get attacked or if anything happens anywhere in any of this, you know, this so-called Project Freedom or something like that in the Persian Gulf, that would be a cause for us to say, ah, see, they're the ones that restarted this. Now we have to respond, almost like that's they were hoping for that outcome. And I mean, evidence is sure pretty not good for us that that's what we may have tried to do. We'll see what happens next.
Do you know what that? I don't know because this is not my area at all. Would that reset the 60-day clock for Trump so he doesn't have to go to Congress?
No. As a matter of fact, I posted a video on my channel this morning specifically on this point. There is a radical misunderstanding, intentionally so, especially among the mainstream media and members of Congress, both Senate and House, where they are intentionally misreading what this law actually says. The 1973 War Powers Act does not in any way, shape, or form give President Trump 60, or any president, 60 days to basically do whatever they want and then come to Congress. To the contrary, the law specifically says there are three and three only reasons why the president may ever choose to use military power. That is, one, that there has already been a congressional delegation declaration, two, specific congressional authorization, or three, we were attacked. If the third one happens, that we were attacked, and so he has to use it without getting congressional approval first, then he has to, within 48 hours, report to Congress why he did it, what the scope is, what's the duration, what's the objective, how long they think we're going to be there, within 48 hours. And then there's a 60-day period where he has to report the answers to all of those things, plus anything else that may come up. And then Congress will decide if it will then declare war or give authorization. None of those things happened at all. So this playing around with President Trump's letter that he put out over the weekend that it reset the clock. It's all fiction. None of it has anything to do with the actual law. It's just to make people not ask hard questions that allow him to keep doing whatever he wants. That's the truth of it.
Oh, that's such a clear explanation. Thank you for that. That really clears it up. So I'm just an armchair guy, probably the worst sort. You know, I sort of observe stuff. But I watched the Ukraine war unfold and I said, wow, warfare sure changed. Obviously, drones are now a thing and it's completely changed the characteristic. If it turns out tonight, the United States and Israel dial in and it turns out Iran is not completely defanged, like Trump keeps saying, what do you think we could really achieve between ourselves and Israel? What would we try to do? What would we try to achieve? And then B, what do you think Iran's responses could be?
Yeah, what we can achieve is we can blow up a lot of stuff. We definitely have some great material to fire weapons, whether that's from cruise ships, cruise missile carrier ships, launching aircraft off the carriers, or from ground-based assets. We can if we can fire JASSMs, long-range cruise missiles, Tomahawk cruise missiles, ATACMs, land-launched missiles. We can do a lot of stuff. Definitely can blow up a lot of things in Iran. But it's not going to accomplish anything other than killing more Iranians. It's not going to change the dynamic. It's not going to do anything about who's in control in Iran. They are going to, the government that exists will continue to exist. It won't do anything to knock out their long-range missiles because they're underground. They're under mountains, and you can't knock them out, or we would already have done it. It's not going to do anything about the fast boats they have, numbering apparently in the thousands. Taking out five today won't even dent their capability. Won't do anything to their ability to put more mines in the strait should they decide to do that, or the naval drones. And then, of course, all of the long-range missiles, that won't do anything to any of that. So they will still be in control. But the worst part is, as you said in the second part of your question, what will Iran do next? And they are already locked and loaded, according to every source that I have. And what they've said publicly is that they are going to go after all of the energy infrastructure throughout the Middle East, not just that one port there. I think that was a shot across the bow, although into the bow, I guess, in certain respects, to say, hey, you're not going to get oil out anywhere. It wouldn't surprise me if Yanbu maybe turn it up next, or maybe if the Bab al-Mandab gets shut down by their ally, the Houthis. I think that could come as well. But I think that if we go back into a full-on U.S.-Israeli attack and start hitting targets everywhere, especially if their energy infrastructure inside of Iran, we can devastate it. We can just turn Karg Island into a smoking hulk. There's no doubt about it. But so can they. They can do the same thing to all of our other Gulf allies. That's what they promised to do. And thus far, Chris, everything they have said they would do, they have done. So you talk about taking people at their word or whatever. Don't believe a lot of stuff, because they've also told a lot of stories. Let's be honest about that, too. They've also claimed that they attacked our aircraft carriers and a bunch of other stuff, and that turned out to be not true. But when they talk about what actions they're going to take if we attack, so far they've done everything they said, and there's no reason to think they won't do it this time either.
Okay, so if they do that, it's unclear to me, based on what I've studied of history, that you can do a lot with an air campaign, but you can't win. Is that true?
Oh, it's 100% true. I wish that President Trump was listening to you. you call yourself an armchair guy, but man, you're doing better than the actual admirals and generals that are advising him, it seems, or at least he doesn't listen to them if they are telling the truth. But throughout history, you've seen, I mean, going back a century, every time somebody has tried to bomb somebody into oblivion and to make them compelled to submit, it always has the opposite effect. It hardens their resolve. Look at Germany during World War II. Look at Britain during World War II, the Battle of Britain. Germany tried to knock them out by having all this aerial campaign. All it did is steal the resolve of the British. When we tried to bomb Iran, Germany in the last part of the wars into submission with firebombing Dresden and all this stuff, all it did was to harden the resolve. They never gave up until an army came in to compel it by taking Berlin. And now that in the current era, you see Hamas in the Gaza Strip. I mean, that place has been turned into a moonscape, and yet they never gave up. Same in Lebanon. The Houthis, for whatever, since 2015, all the way through, first with the Saudis and us, then Israeli, they never gave up. So why does anybody think that you're going to bomb a country as big as most of Western Europe with huge mountain ranges that they can hide behind and use for defensive capabilities or put their facilities underground? why does anybody think that some bombs on a relatively short period of time is going to bring them to their knees? Look at how long it took Israel to try and bring Gaza to its knees. How many years, 2 years plus, that they've done that, and they still haven't brought them to their knees. So no, they're not going to win with air power only.
I know what's plaguing you. You feel like everybody around you has gone insane. Hello, Dr. Chris Martinson here. Look, we've built a world on cheap oil, endless growth, and borrowed time. But the cracks are showing. Inflation's up, resources are thinning, and the old rules don't seem to apply anymore. I've tracked this for years, from the crash course to today, and I'm not here to sugarcoat it. At Peak Prosperity, I'm your information scout, hunting down the facts, cutting through the noise, and showing you how to adapt. This isn't just information, it's a lifeline. The game is changing fast. Are you ready? Subscribe to Peak Prosperity now, and let's get ahead of the curve. Again, from my armchair standpoint, we do this decapitation strike, which I have strong objections to. It felt dishonorable to me, right? You negotiate with people and then bomb them later if you want to. But mid-negotiation, I'm not a fan. But regardless, we do that. Within 5 minutes, they're already dialing in. And within 24 hours, we'd lost all kinds of radar and critical infrastructure and military bases and all kinds of stuff. Wouldn't we have, at 24 hours at the latest, sort of sat back and said, huh, this isn't the same as Venezuela. This is going to be a very different caliber of enemy. Who's in charge of giving that information to the president?
Yeah. yes, I know for sure from some folks who were at least part of the time were in the room or at least were in the administration senior positions at that time. And there were plenty of people that were telling him the right stuff. There were people that were telling him the right stuff before it happened, that the Hormuz would be taken over, that it would cause all this economic damage, that they would retaliate in the way that they did, that assassinating their leaders is not going to knock them out. All those things he was told. He just chose not to listen because he was balanced out and drowned out, as it turned out, by other voices that said, no, it'll work. Trust me. I mean, men like Lindsey Graham, Mark Levin, Mark Thiessen. I mean, you know, great military minds. Mm-hmm. Don't know why he would listen to them over the military. Yep. But then there was also like Jack Keane, General Kellogg, apparently two others he listens to a lot. Now, they do have, you know, former 3- and 4-star generals. But their track record is just insanely bad. Now, one would have imagined that when you started that, like you said, when you got to like the fourth or fifth day and you've basically shot the majority of your stuff and you've hit all the military targets that potentially could matter, and it didn't bring them to their knees, it didn't cause them to collapse internally, didn't make the local people that were against the regime rise up in support of us, which was always weird, that we thought that might happen. And it didn't clear out the Gulf of Hormuz. What we should have done then is said, all right, let's get this thing over with by whatever we can to limit the damage, because any kind of cursory knowledge and examination is going to show that the longer this goes on, the more problems that are very predictable. I mean, you probably know better than most, these shockwave experiments that were done in like 2005, 7, 9, I think several years, where they looked at exactly this kind of thing about a supply disruption and what kind of impacts that had. It's well known. People knew what would happen. And those shocks looked at a smaller percentage of interruption of oil than what we're actually experiencing here. So God only knows where the upside of all this is actually going to go. But you again, to your question, circling back, why aren't the people who were making the decisions looking at this evidence and analysis that's already been done on the subject? And I just don't understand. Other than that, there are certainly those in Israel, and we know for sure Benjamin Netanyahu is a primary one there, and a lot of his supporters, and virtually every person on that list I just mentioned are big-time Israeli supporters. They keep telling him, no, just a little more, Mr. President, just another big hit, and that's finally going to topple him over. It's just wishful thinking. There's no military ration behind it. There's no economic ration behind it. And if we do launch back into a full-on round two, and we're poised for it, I can tell you that for sure, that there's this truth that we do have a ton of combat power in the region now, more than we had at the start of this. There's a lot of things that are going to be blown up in Iran, but it's not going to change anything of those fundamentals I mentioned. They're going to still be in control of the Strait of Hormuz, except now then a bunch of the region is going to be burning there right now isn't. And I fear what may follow that if that goes down that path.
I can't see anything other than hardening resolve. And in particular, what's going to go down is probably one of the most spectacularly unfortunate moments of timing for the United States was you attack a theocratic regime. They've been under a 13-year drought. And a month into that, rains come back. Now, whose side is God on?
Oh, man. Yeah, that was hard to miss. A lot of people in Iran were noticing that.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I mean, it would be easy to interpret it that way, if you wanted to. But now, so the other thing here that's, I don't understand Trump's negotiating style, but, he didn't seem to negotiate at all, honestly, through this whole thing, beginning, middle, and end. But now that it's happened, it's emerged that he didn't really consult anybody about this, right? And then once it's already like a disaster, he's sort of trying to berate people into getting involved. Come on, UK. Come on, France. Come on, Spain. But then he did it recently in following this. So China actually ordered its companies in the country not to comply with U.S. sanctions. This is an enormous deal on five domestic refiners linked to the Iranian oil trade, a move aimed at softening the impact of penalties. So China's basically for the first time just stood right up and said, you know what? We're not that scared of you anymore. So really, I always thought I was heavily weighted towards 85%. I thought we would escalate because I feel like the empire has this need to show it's powerful. But we've already shown that we can't open the strait by force. I really quake in fear of what will happen if we try and put boots on the ground, as it were. I'll get your statement on that in a second. But now we're trying to come out and tell people like China, hey, he says here today, the U.S. calls on China to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. So these feel like kind of too little, too late to cobble together sort of an international coalition to help with a problem that Trump and Bibi created all on their own.
Wow, I did not see that. That was used to be that we're asking for China's help now after just sanctioning them, 48 hours ago. That seems to be inopportune timing, as you said, I guess. But it also just exposes the lack of a strategy that we have, the lack of a comprehension of how things work at this level, which is shocking. You would never have ever uttered that in association with any American administration, no matter what party in our history. That's always been one of our strong points. And now then it's like amateur hour, which is shocking to me, even with Trump, because that wasn't the case in Trump's first administration. It was not this incompetent. But now that across the board, they're acting just crazy, if I can just be honest about it. And this idea that you're going to coerce China right now to do something that we want, and you're going to sanction them and think that they're going to do it, they're going to abide by it. And now then they're, my take is that China is probably as smart as you and I are. And they're probably looking at they're counting barrels of oil. They're counting what's not on there anymore. They're seeing physically what's happened. They understand that there's going to be this inflection point pretty soon where you can't paper over the price of oil, and it's going to be, there's just going to not be enough to do economic activity, as you said on our show the other day. And I think they're going, sure, you want to play a game of chicken? We'll add another. You're doing that in the Gulf right now. We'll do it here too, because I think that because China is historically risk averse, and they have always kind of tried to navigate around stuff. But the fact that they came out this time and said, yeah, no, we're not going to do that, I think because they know that this is a short clock that's remaining, that we're not going to be paying any attention to what happens with five Chinese companies here pretty quick. We're going to be trying to bail out a sinking ship here in our own home country. And so I think that's my guess anyway. It's my interpretation of what China's doing. And for Trump to go in and now say, hey, you want to help us out? What motivation does China have to help us out, unless it's to say, all right, for our own interest, we need to have some stability in the global marketplace. So we need to get this thing off the table. So maybe we'll help that. But listen, there's no chance on God's earth that China is going to get Iran to have a deal that benefits Washington. There's no way that's going to happen. They may say, look, we'll give you some areas around the margin. We'll get them to that. But I mean, Iran is never leaving control of the Strait of Hormuz willingly. They'll never do it. And this reprocessed nuclear material, they'll never just give that up. And they're certainly not going to abandon their proxies or give up their long-range weapons. I think they still won't go to a nuclear weapon. I don't think they want to. They now see that their missiles and the control of the Strait will provide the benefit of a nuclear weapon without having the negatives that go with it. But those are some pretty major asks that Trump wants all of on his side, and I don't think he's going to get any of them.
So I want to talk about the options Iran has for closing the strait. So they put this up today. Here they are launching these cruise missiles. The point I wanted to make here, Daniel, is they're launching them clearly from truck-based platforms. And so this whole idea we've heard, like, oh, the mines, they're going to mine the strait, they're going to do this, and we'll clear the mines. Mines are just one of many ways they can keep the strait fully locked down. Can you please cover what those options really are?
Right. Yeah, there are long, medium, and short-range missiles that Iran has in its inventories literally spread to the four winds of its country all over the place. Most of them are underneath these mountains that I mentioned, and we can't penetrate them. And we've tried. We knew where some of them are, not all of them, and we've tried to knock them out. And from all the reporting I can see, they have somewhere around 40 of these things, and we've allegedly hit part of one. That's a rumor. That's not confirmed, but there's some pretty good reporting that's the case. But that's it. And so all the rest of them they have still intact. And some of them we have hit the exit ramps where we're able to determine so that you can't, you know, get things in and out. But during this pause, they fixed a lot of that stuff. And in fact, they have engineering units whose job it is, they expect to be hit. They expect these tunnel exits to be hit. So they have engineering units that can clear it away. And even before the ceasefire, we had several observed options where, like, 2 or 3 days later, they had the things back unblocked again to where they can get out. Because these things are so far in there, you can blow up the entrance, but, you know, 10, 15 meters underground, that's about all you're going to damage. And the assets inside some of these, and I've actually worked in a facility like this here in the U.S. It's called Site R, which is where the command centers, the command authorities would go in the event of a nuclear war, where they could operate from inside of a mountain. I won't say which one or where it was, but I had to go operate in there for a while during the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, the 2003 war, because we didn't know if there might be some retaliation. So I have seen what those things are like inside, and they can literally survive nuclear blasts. So Iran has similar technology also in many of these that are that strong. So you're not going to ever knock them out. So you can continue like those videos there. Almost certainly trucks came out of these bunkers, fired their payload, and then immediately went back in and hid. And I'm sure that by the time the last round went out of the back of the truck, they were depressing the launcher and then drove back into their holes. We can't stop that. So that's one. And there's, you know, long, medium, and short range. In some places, especially along both the Gulf of Oman side and the Persian Gulf side, artillery, just regular artillery, can range a lot of those things. All you have to be able to do is plausibly hit the ships, or like what happened in the opening round here, some of these naval drones, like the kind we saw used in the Ukraine-Russia war, that moved the entire Black Sea fleet to leave Sevastopol and go further back towards Russia. That's the impact. It's something simple with a country that doesn't even have a navy. So Trump keeps talking about how we knock out their navy, but we've seen that even a country without a navy, but if it has these small boats, they're just really hard to knock out because they're so small and they've got a lot of them. And that's another. And then, of course, they still have a number of submarines. They still have a number of what they call underwater missiles, which are navigable missiles that can be launched from underwater. And some of these mountains, these cliffs that you may have seen in the strait, God only knows where all those are. Those are underwater. We don't know where those exit points are. So all of those things combined. And then, of course, I think the fast ships that we mentioned a minute ago, you would have to take over the whole country to knock all those things out. So even if you disable two or three of those categories, there's too many other categories that you can't stop. So there is literally no practical way to open the Strait of Hormuz by force unless the political government is literally eliminated and they can't get any war. And I don't see any possibility of that happening either. That's how big the task is.
Well, and to add to that task, can you help us understand? So Iraq, Iran, maybe some people think it's a difference of a letter, but Iraq is kind of flat and Iran is very mountainous. Can you talk about the role of geography in this for us?
Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. That's the reason why you don't see any ground forces here. A lot of people have said, well, look, let's use a ground force. In the first part of this, you may recall somebody says, you know what, let's get the Kurds. That's what we can do, because there's a lot of Kurds in that region there that are separated in Turkey, Iraq, and in Iran, and let's get them all together, and then they can march on Tehran. And to that, I said, have you ever looked at a relief map of Iran? First of all, there's big political reasons why the Iraqi Kurds would not and did not join in with that. But even if all of them did and decided that, yes, we're all going to band together, I mean, they would be wiped out because you would have to go over mountains and, or through mountain passes, which makes it really easy to knock anybody out. When you compare like Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, the Iraq from the places that we came in, like in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, et cetera, from their entry points, potentially we could have possibly come in from the north, from Turkey, though that got turned off. But it's it was theoretically possible. The terrain was I marched over this in 1991 in the Persian Gulf War. We were part of the U.S. 7th Corps at the vanguard of that with the 7th Corps and the 2nd Armored Cav Regiment. We literally just drove I forget how many hundreds of kilometers over flat terrain. I mean, it was just like driving through a parking lot. It was that easy. You just as much as you wanted to. Iran, on the other hand, the reason why we haven't even toyed, never even thought about having a ground army like that, 300,000, 500,000, something like that, is because the only path that we have is over mountains. I mean, I served in my last combat deployment in Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time in the mountains in between Pakistan and Afghanistan border, and they're the same kind of mountains. I think some of them are actually the same mountain range extended further. And I remember thinking, we went on one combat patrol to the northernmost American outpost in the northeastern part of Afghanistan, and we could only go so far on a very narrow mountain path over the Kunar River Valley, and at some point we had to actually dismount and walk the rest of the way up to it because the roads were so narrow. And if you tried that with an army, I mean, you would just be obliterated because all the enemy would have to do is just hang out in the mountainside somewhere and rain down artillery, drones, some missile fire. I mean, it wouldn't be that hard because you would be canalized in the terrain and makes it easy for the defense. So there is no military path for ground troops to do anything other than seize a point target, something which we could conceivably do, although that would come at extremely high cost and produce zero of strategic value. So it wouldn't matter if you can physically do it because it wouldn't translate into any benefit other than to get more of your people killed. It wouldn't change the other dynamics I mentioned about how they can control the Strait of Hormuz, et cetera. So that is why it was easy for us to drive up in Iraq. And, of course, there were no drones then either, which that would have profoundly complicated it if that had existed in 2003 or 1991. But now then, along with the drones, it is a suicide mission to even make the attempt.
Yeah, that was my instinct. So if we did say, I don't know, boots on the island, we seize Karg Island, that would really just be more for demonstration purposes than real strategic benefit, I guess.
It would be more for death purposes. Yeah, number one, you don't need boots on the ground to destroy the stuff. You can do that with missiles and our own drones from a distance. And if you wanted to take control of it, you wouldn't, because Iran is, I mean, they know this. That was a point of contention during the Iran-Iraq war. So they're experts at understanding how to take care of that problem if it comes in. And I've been told by some Iranian officials, one of whom was in the Pakistan negotiating team, that their plan would be to let us take the island, not even stop the helicopter, because we can only do it with helicopters right now. They would let us land, and then they would start bringing in all the fire so that now you can't resupply them, you can't support them, and yeah, all the stuff on the island is going to burn and get blown up, but so will all your troops. You won't be able to get them off, and it would be the biggest military defeat that we've had. I mean, I was going to say since Vietnam, but really going back to Korea, I think is the last time at the Chosun River, I think is the last time we really suffered a operational level defeat. I think you have to go back that far.
Wow. All right. So I'm going to show you something here, which is, you know, there's a clock ticking, obviously, and we've got to do something. And here's part of the ticking clock. So today, Besant said, temporary aberration will be over in weeks or months. He's talking about oil, right? Temporary aberration in weeks or months. Okay. Can I just say that JP Morgan put out this very helpful thing that showed that there's both an operational stress level that we're heading towards for refining and compared to inventories, and then there's an operational floor level, which they just can't function below that. So I've sort of waggishly said, I think weeks is $200 a barrel and months is $500 a barrel. Scott Besant may not know what he's up to or talking about, but weeks and months means this is a pretty fast ticking clock. We don't have a year or 2 years to sort of hang out in the Kandahar Valley and sort of figure stuff out and, you know, let things limp along. What can we realistically do? And I'm going to raise the prospect now of, is anybody going to be thinking nuclear at some point in this story?
Yeah. Yeah. That's been my worry from the beginning, especially after the first 5 or 6 days when it was clear that the conventional weapons were not going to be able to get the outcome. I feared getting to the point to where we tried everything we can with the conventional weapons and the strait was still closed and they were still not giving up. And there is no doubt in my mind that there are people whispering in his ear right now. Look, Mr. President, I mean, we can go in with we can assemble 500,000 troops with allies and everything else and calling up the National Guard and reserves. And we can go in and probably do that, but we would cause 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 casualties that we would lose. Or we could do like President did in 1945 and say, well, I don't want to risk all those troops, so we'll solve the problem with a nuclear weapon, and we'll drop one and ask them if they want to surrender. We'll drop another. You can see them having that conversation because it is very alluring. Part of that Axios report out that was this morning I mentioned earlier, they say that he did this, President Trump did this whole thing with the whatever, this sort of quasi-mission to allow people to go through, the not really escort mission, was because he was getting antsy and he was getting impatient. He didn't want to keep waiting. He didn't want to have this. He didn't want to go back to the hot war. He needed something to happen soon because he's so impatient. And I'm thinking, when you're impatient to get a war over with right now and you're in a ceasefire situation that's unsolvable and you're not willing to use negotiations and diplomacy, meaning to give something in order to get something, you just want to demand everything, that's never going to work, then you can say, okay, especially if he starts looking at that clock and it starts imposing itself because the disparity between the actual price of a barrel of oil right now and the paper price, they're going to start to come back into equilibrium by force, no matter how much he wants to manipulate it. And when that starts happening, and then you have the commensurate, I just filled up my gas tank yesterday for $95, which has never happened in my adult lifetime. Not even back in the COVID era, it never got that expensive, at least not for us. And we're at the beginning of this thing. And if that keeps going up and now that it's over $100 to fill up a tank of gas, that's going to start hurting everybody. And then that's going to put more pressure on President Trump to take the easy way out. Or so he thinks it would be easy. I think it would be catastrophic for so many reasons, but I do fear that thought could cross his mind.
And what are those reasons that it would be catastrophic? Tell me what the blowback might be.
Well, I mean, number one, anytime you cross that threshold of using a nuclear weapon, I mean, can we be guaranteed that maybe Pakistan won't try and retaliate for their cousins over there? We would be the pariah of the world. I think even our allies would turn against us then. I don't think that either Russia or China would use nuclear weapons. It's certainly not right away, because then they would also receive them. They don't want to receive any, but they want to make sure that we don't use them. And they would do everything to make certain that we had a huge price put on us so that we don't use them. Because if you use nuclear weapons and you get away with it, then Trump's going to be in office for 2.5 more years. Why would they think he wouldn't think to resort to it again? I think that they would get together with all of our other allies even, and certainly other neutral countries, and I think that we would for the first time be subject to sanctions. I think that they would put as much pressure as possible on as broad around the world, and it'll be hard for our allies, whether in Asia or in Europe, to say no to doing something like that, because it'll be so alarming that everyone would lose if we get into an expanded nuclear war. So I think that we would destroy our credibility as being this global force for good. We used to love to call ourselves that. No one would believe that if they do anyway already. But if you cross that threshold there too, I didn't even touch on the actual economic impacts of all this, which would just seal in, I think, a depression of duration. Who knows who could even participate or anticipate? But I just think that so many things would go bad, and I just hope that somebody wouldn't use a nuclear weapon or take action. If we use a nuclear weapon against Iran, why would they not try to hit us back in our homeland in whatever means they have? And so I think we would be spawning local attacks, whether you want to call those lone wolf attacks, sleeper cells, or them just sending people over. I mean, I can't imagine if my country was attacked like that, that I would not do something to make sure their homeland was also hit, whether it's a dirty bomb, something else. I don't know what. I shudder to think what they could do, what angry people can do when you've left them no alternatives. But those are some of the things that would potentially fall out if we use nuclear weapons.
I agree with that assessment. And one of the scenarios that, Daniel, that really alarms me as a possibility is if China decides that we're, as Russia says, non-agreement capable, but we're also not capable of holding to any sort of like word of honor. If they decide, hey, all of a sudden y'all look like rabid dogs, and they just say, you know what, until you get some regime change at home we can believe in, we're not going to trade with you anymore. If they did that, yeah, our economy is out of business inside of 6 months, because we just, it's not just rubber shoes and things. Like, a lot of people don't think, understand just how integral Chinese exports are to our military, our telecommunications, our high-tech industries, our chemical industries, our pharmaceuticals. Like, the list is really dangerously long. So Trump puts it as our strength. They need us as a trading partner because we buy so much of their stuff. But the truth is, actually, it's our Achilles heel, because it's any point in time they could just say, we're not going to deal with you anymore. Does that... That's sort of the Rubicon,
and
I think.
And all the manufacturing, just the manufacturing industry alone, how much of it we already farm out to China? If that suddenly was over with, I mean, how would we even do a lot of the stuff we do here domestically? Because some of the stuff we sell here is because it's manufactured over there because of our companies. And if that got cut off, I mean, we can't just turn that manufacturing genie back on here. I mean, it would take, I would wager, decades to actually get back into any kind of scale. If there's money for that, and if you're talking about doing it in the middle of a depression, I mean, it could be catastrophic for our country, just catastrophic.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's possible, because you'd have to start by undoing ungodly amounts of rules and regulations that prevent us from starting things quickly anyway, you know? So if China wants to build a 50 square mile car plant like BYD just did, they just do that, you know? I don't think that could happen. All right. So, but the other option here, of course, is for Trump, for whoever's advising him, to say, you know, why don't we just negotiate? We'll give Iran some things they want. We won't get everything we want. They don't get everything they want, but we just back off. And is that just taking too much of an L for them to consider?
We should do that. That's exactly what I've been pleading with the administration to do, exactly that, because at this point, that's the only thing that makes any sense. Because we chose to start this war that any kind of sober analysis would show you couldn't win militarily, and other than just a roll of the dice hope that they would collapse like Venezuela did, and there was no reason to think that, but I guess it was theoretically possible. But because we chose to do that, now then we have baked in failure. We can't win in any way, no matter if we escalate with more conventional force. We just can't win, because they can outlast us with the cost of all this. And so because we did that, there is no good outcome, even theoretically possible. The only outcome now is possible theoretically and logically is to agree to whatever terms that we can get to get the war over with, and that will leave Iran in control of the Strait of Hormuz. It will leave them with their missile capabilities, their allies, et cetera, and a tremendously elevated reputational gain on the backside, commensurate with the loss on our side. But we don't lose any more people. Oil gets back out. We probably maybe could avoid a depression. I don't think we could avoid a recession. I think that's already too late for that. But at least we're still in control. We haven't lost any more men. We haven't lost any more ships. The Gulf still is able to produce oil. That is absolutely the best case scenario right now. But Trump's ego is the one that's writing the checks, and I don't need to tell you how likely it is that that's going to happen.
Well, then, it really puts one man's lack of humility up against what's going to become a humanitarian crisis, because we haven't even touched on the fertilizer that hasn't made it out. And right, the fact that the spring planting season is now far enough along that we're starting to close that window for expanded crop yields for proper fertilizer application. This could be a really tough next fall, next spring, if this doesn't resolve.
Yeah. I mean, all the way into next year. That, I mean, because of the problems that you just described, just in the food alone is already baking in now food shortages or insufficient enough later, and everything is more expensive, which just has compounding effects that you know better than most. It'll probably be next planting season before we can start to maybe get out of that. That may already be baked in too, but man, the longer this goes, and if we do start back up with the full war, you know, today or tomorrow, I shudder to think that the consequences, yeah, not just to us, but to Asia, Europe, Africa, this all kinds of problems.
So for anybody listening, if the war kicks off again, re-escalates tonight, is there anything you personally going to do differently to prepare or get ready? Or
I have been investing in a number of, I've invested in some gold, I've invested in some of the market here, frankly. Would I still see some pretty low prices in August and September on the futures market? I don't see any chance that's going to stay anywhere where it's at. I'm actually thinking about getting a few more food items that have long shelf life here just in the next couple of weeks, especially if something kicks off, because we could start running out of important things just like we did during the COVID time, except this time the reasons why are more practical and fundamental and could potentially be longer lasting.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing. It's food and fuel, those two things, which means I just picked up a pallet of solar panels the other day, just yesterday, from some place they bought too many, so they let them go for cheap. And that's the kind of thing that I think if we do get into some sort of a difficulty with exports from China, those will go away really quick. And I'm considering those to be almost like things that I would be able to trade for favors locally with people, things like that. I did buy an electric car a month and a half ago because I saw this coming. And so at least I will be able to take my solar panels and I can just, my car charges,
Yeah.
So I never thought I'd be an electric car guy, but looking at this, I can't discount the idea of actual shortages coming to our country. And that's if and only if this ends soon. And if and only if we don't accidentally escalate it. And if and only if we don't cross a Rubicon of some kind and do something that really makes the world turn against us.
Indeed. Yeah. I worry about everything you just said.
Well, sobering, but as you know how I like it, I like the truth, whatever it is. So thank you so much for your time today. And please tell people where they can follow you.
We are on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube or at Daniel L. Davis, the number one on X. And I think we're a few other places too, but those are the main two places where people can find us pretty quickly.
Yeah, excellent show. So everybody, if you want to stay current and aware of what's actually going on, highly recommend Daniel's show. So with that, Daniel, hey, thanks so much for your time today. I hope we don't have to do this again in 48 hours.
I do too. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.